Welcome back. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. So we're lucky today. We have in studio joining us is Christian Williams. He's the author of Our Enemies in Blue, and he's going to be holding an event tonight in Highland Park at Flor y Canto, which is 3706 North Figueroa. So welcome, Christian.
Thank you.
And your book, it's very comprehensive. I mean, literally a lot of folks are talking, is tracing the history of policing. And you're going to be doing an event tonight that's being hosted by the Youth Justice Coalition, Critical Resistance, and No New Jails Coalition. So why don't you give just a brief snippets for our listeners. So what are some of the highlights when you're looking at this history? What are some important markers that people need to know to help debunk what people aren't aware of?
Probably the first thing is how new the institution of the modern police really is. We're encouraged to think of the police as just a necessary feature of modern society, when, in fact, this institution in the form that we have it now really only goes back about 200 years. And in the book, I trace out the history beginning slightly before the modern institution, when there were other means of law enforcement. And I try to identify the factors that led into the creation of the modern police. And what I found was that the single largest social institution that led into this organization was was slavery. And the relationship between the slave patrols, which were sort of specialized militia units that had responsibility for enforcing slave laws and preventing revolts and breaking up any unauthorized meetings of slaves, evolved in a very short amount of time into the institution that we have now. That's probably that sort of origin story, and the fact that it's as recent as it is, I think is probably the most important thing to start with.
You know, it's fascinating that you take it back there, because I think, I mean, obviously, if you were just looking at it strictly from an economic point of view, obviously, it sort of the role of the police is connected to the rise of capitalism in itself, you know. But I think if we sort of flip it inside the United States in particular, and we connect it both, I would say, obviously, I think the slave patrol, but if we look at the role of the Rangers in Texas against the Mexicano communities in the border area, you know, I think, unfortunately, you know, we're having an election right now in Los Angeles, as you know, and it's always interesting to me that when everybody talks about police, to me, it's always a key word to speak to essentially a white voter to say, we'll have your back, we'll protect you from sort of all these evils that are surrounding you. Why do you think it's so, if that is the origins, do you think that's why it's so such a key word when somebody speaks about crime and the police and the rise of police or the need for more police, so tied to the concept of people, sort of feeling in many ways threatened by sort of an uncontrollable groupings of people out there?
The rhetoric about crime is often coded talk about class, and now especially about race. And that's something that politicians have been very acutely aware of, especially since the 60s, where it became less acceptable to talk about, it became less acceptable to advocate maintaining white supremacy. And they needed to find some other way to sort of mask that same agenda. Crime was a very convenient way of doing that, largely because it played to the prejudices that were already there. But it could be couched in this ostensibly race-neutral language.
Hmm. Well, why don't we? One of the things that I think that you talk a lot about extensively in the book is talking about, well, if what is the alternative? Because I think there's two things that will come up as an organizer, you know, when we're out organizing on the bus. One of the things we try to talk to people about is, well, one, why don't we have less police, you know, which for people it's like a crazy idea, you know. And second, why don't we even reduce what's even considered a crime, given that in the last 20 years almost every aspect of urban life in many ways has become criminalized, you know, and like
right.
from tagging to breaking a window.
Worse than that, things like loitering and having an open container and, you know, in some places, things that are really the fabric of community life, things like loud parties,
mm-hmm.
have been increasingly seen as matters for police attention rather than positive community aspects or like simple nuisances. Instead, they're increasingly criminalized.
So give us the alternatives, because obviously right now most people's alternative, if you sort of go in through into, you know, mainstream, you know, sort of circles, one of the main things they're talking a lot about is community policing. And to me, community policing in many ways is code word for, you know, my family's from El Salvador, and code word for community policing is like orden. You know, it's a group that is really working with the government to sort of suppress whole communities. So talk to us about what are alternatives beyond that kind of concept that you're sort of looking into the book.
Right. I talk about this pretty extensively at the very end. The afterword is titled Making Police Obsolete. And rather than construct a sort of anarchist fantasy of, you know, what I would like to see happen, I took the approach of looking at specific historical situations where social conflict has become so acute that the government authorities have been forced to retreat and the police have not been available to do their job as they usually have. And I talk about sort of short-lived experiments in the United States. Probably the most interesting was the Seattle General Strike in 1919, where the police were at that point totally focused on breaking the strike and were not paying very much attention to crime. The unions found themselves in a position of holding more power overall than the city government did, and they were very aware of the danger of panic or looting or anything like that. And they organized union members who had served in World War I to patrol unarmed and without any authority to use force. It was like explicitly in their instructions that their only tool was persuasion to dissuade people from disorder. And they took other steps as well to meet the needs of the community during the strike. And when the military finally intervened, the military officials were just astonished at how orderly the city was. Mm-hmm. I also look at more developed examples, longer-term examples from countries overseas. And the two that I really discuss extensively are the work of the street committees in South Africa during the apartheid era. These were committees formed by the anti-apartheid civic organizations, because there, in that circumstance, there was really just no pretense that the police were interested in doing anything about crime or meeting the community's needs. And so that left these communities very vulnerable to crime. The anti-apartheid movement felt like it needed to step in and do something instead. And the form that they came up with was a extremely localized, directly democratic sort of neighborhood council that mostly focused on a restorative rather than a retributive form of justice, meaning they wanted to repair the damage that had been done and preserve the community rather than, you know, finding the bad guy and punishing him. The other example that I talk about very extensively is from Northern Ireland, where conflicts became acute enough in the 70s that the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the British police, just withdrew from militant areas of Belfast and Derry, which, of course, left those areas very vulnerable to crime, especially because they had astronomical unemployment rates. This then led the community to put pressure on the IRA to do something about crime, which the IRA was not very good at. They hadn't prepared for it, and really the only tools that they had available were violence, which then caused them a political problem where they had to do something about crime, but the only thing that they could do was costing them their popularity. They approached a group of scholars and asked them to help design a system of conflict resolution that could be above ground, work within the law, not rely on violence. And a program called the Community Restorative Justice System of Northern Ireland came out of that. And it and has meets the criteria that they outlined and is has been remarkably successful and very popular in the areas where they have it. And tellingly, the only people who are opposed to this program are the police.
It's interesting that in both of those models, you're talking about this very distinct national liberation struggles, you know, that were fighting, you know, either a colonial power or in South Africa, you know, colonizers who took over their land. So let's talk about, I know we got about a minute and a half or so. So why don't we talk to you about then the dilemma then, what happens when the National Liberation Movement actually takes power and now becomes sort of the central piece of the state and has to provide policing as an aspect of their work?
The as that played out in South Africa, the anti-apartheid movement both tried to take state control and to benefit from popular direct action. And it succeeded in both of those, and now it's left trying to reconcile the two. And the street committees in most places persist, and they are responsible for low-level offenses and for neighborhood disputes and for problems with your landlord and for resolving things with creditors and that sort of thing. In the meantime, there is a police system. And I think that it's at least that these cases aren't followed through to their most radical conclusion, but they at least suggest the possibility that something other than a state-run police system could succeed in maintaining the peace.
So we've got the last minute, and just wrapping up a bit, I know you're active in Portland, in the Portland Cop Watch. Can you tell us a little bit about it? And then let's go on to this, within the last 30 seconds, this your event tonight at 7 p.m. in Flor y Canto.
I'm a member of Rose City Cop Watch, which is in Portland, Oregon. And we do direct observation of the police and patrols and document police misconduct when it occurs. We also train people about their rights when dealing with the police. We've also done other things like at one point we hung up posters of two recent killer cops. The event tonight, I'm mostly going to talk about racial profiling.
Okay. Well, everybody should, if you're free tonight, 7 p.m., Flor y Canto, 3706 North Figueroa in Highland Park. So we're wrapping up.
So we'd like to thank our guests today, Richard Moore, Kat Rodriguez, Diane Fugino, and Christian Williams. Shout-outs to our producer, Alan Minsky, and our engineer, Maggie LaPeak. Today we had music from Nina Simone, Charles Mingus, and Public Enemy. You've been listening to Voices from the Frontline. This is Manuel Criollo. If you're interested in this show, you can go check out our website at thestrategycenter.org. Again, thestrategycenter.org, and click on Voices from the Frontline. Stay tuned for Susie Wiseman on Beneath the Surface. Beneath the Surface, Susie will be speaking with legendary activist and author Tariq Ali. So don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. I wish I could break.